funded model, the debt-driven model that we have in place. So we have to work to organize faculty at those institutions who can shift the balance of power there so that they're not obstacles. And of course, there's always the conservatives who say, well, what's next? You're going to cancel student debt and come for medical debt? You're going to come for the $20-30 billion of back rent people owe? And so they're against debt cancellation. But to that, the debt collective says, yes, indeed. Student loans shouldn't exist, neither should medical bills, and yes, people should have the right to housing.
And of course, President Biden's from Delaware. Isn't that where so many of those creditors are based?
Indeed, President Biden is from Delaware, which is the one of the finance capitals of the world. And I think, you know, what motivates Biden here is a very dated conception of who a student debtor is. We hear this, you know, there has been a shift in his rhetoric. He was boxed into a corner on the campaign trail, was forced to run on debt cancellation, thanks to years and years of grassroots organizing and pressure. The minute he's in office, he starts hemming and hawing and talking about the fact that, you know, oh, well, do we want to cancel the debts for lawyers and doctors? So I think he's got to, you know, in addition to his financial ties, he doesn't understand, you know, who actually is pursuing higher education in this country, who is burdened by debt, the fact that 40% of student debtors don't even have a college degree.
We want to thank Esther Taylor for being with us, co-director of the Debt Collective. And that does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Matt Ely. We have an immediate jobs opening for a news writer producer. Go to democracynow.org for information. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Granny D. I'm talking from KBOO, Portland.
Cable is proud to co-sponsor the return of Portland Folk Music Society concerts with artists
funding
to tour nationally.
State level.
The series continues
and
this month on Saturday, April 16th, with guitarist
KBOO
Pat Donahue.
On my email. It is often mentioned as one of the most progressive and daring stations that we have in this country. They are not afraid to tell you the truth. So tune in to KBOO Portland and get the real
The Portland
word.
Folk Music Series has one show every month through June. The concerts will be at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steel Street in Portland. For information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we bring you voices from Take Our Poverty, Not Our Children, which was organized in February of 2022 by the National Welfare Rights Union. It was part of an ongoing Truth Commission series. Today's voices focus on the unjust taking of children by child welfare agencies across the United States, not because of abuse, but because of poverty. Increasingly, poverty is being confused with neglect. Indeed, given the widespread poverty across the world, if this same standard was used, millions of children would be removed from their family. In the United States, for example, in Detroit, Michigan, and other parts of the U.S., children are being removed from their mothers or primary caregivers because the families can't afford to pay their water bills. In Los Angeles and other places, children are removed due to housing insecurity of their families. In several states across the nation, children are removed and placed in foster care or put up for adoption simply because their mothers are victims of domestic abuse. So rather than money and other resources going to help families who are struggling together and to keep their children from being removed, thus traumatizing them, the children are removed and families are broken up. You will hear those voices today. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines. headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Secretary of State Antony Blinken will be in Brussels today to meet with his counterparts from NATO and G7 allies to coordinate a Western response after gruesome images of Russian atrocities against civilians in Ukraine have emerged over the past few days. Feature Story News' Rosie Burchard reports from Brussels.
Previewing the meeting of foreign ministers, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg warned he believed Russia could be preparing a new push in eastern and southern Ukraine in a bid to take the entire Donbas region. Stoltenberg says he expects NATO allies to keep sending weapons to Ukraine. Still, no movement is expected on NATO's policy to stay out of the conflict, meaning no NATO boots on the ground in Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Brussels for the talks, which will also see NATO allies pledge to increase cooperation with New Zealand, Australia, Japan, and the Republic of Korea in areas like arms control and cybersecurity. Rosie Burchard, Brussels.
The White House has announced it's sending more military assistance to Ukraine in its fight to repel the Russian invasion. The Biden administration approved a $100 million transfer of Javelin anti-armor missiles to Ukraine on Tuesday. The transfer brings the total of U.S. military assistance for Ukraine to $2.4 billion since Biden took office last year. The White House announced late Tuesday that Biden approved the assistance, which is funded as part of a broader $13.6 billion in aid for Ukraine approved by Congress last month after Russia's invasion. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters Tuesday that the administration is committed to getting Ukraine the weapons it needs to continue the fight.
And we are focusing that effort on ensuring it is equipment that the Ukrainians are trained on and that they have already been using effectively in this war to fight the Russians.
The administration confirmed that it was for a transfer of the Javelin missiles, which have been requested by the Ukrainian military to combat Russian armor. The announcement of new military assistance came as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky delivered an impassioned plea to a special session of the UN Security Council Tuesday for more assistance for his country. California environmental activists are calling on state officials to halt imports of Russian energy while that country continues its war in Ukraine. And as Suzanne Potter reports, environmentalists say the boycott would also signal a move away from fossil fuels for the state.
Rallies are set for this Friday in 10 cities across California, from Sacramento to San Diego. Ukrainian immigrant Igor Tregub, chair of the California Democratic Party Environmental Caucus, says the country must stop the importation of any Russian fossil fuels.
We vote with our dollars and no longer rely on authoritarian petrostates that murder citizens of neighboring democratic countries.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
President Biden is ordering new national research on long COVID while also directing federal agencies to support patients dealing with the condition. The White House said Tuesday that Biden is ordering the Department of Health and Human Services to coordinate an urgent new initiative across federal agencies, building on research already underway at the National Institutes of Health. Biden also directed federal agencies to support patients and doctors by providing science-based best practices for treating long COVID, maintaining access to insurance coverage, and protecting the rights of workers coping with the condition. The World Health Organization reports that the number of coronavirus cases reported globally has dropped for a second consecutive week. In its latest pandemic report, the WHO said 9 million cases were reported last week, or a 16% weekly decline. The more than 26,000 new deaths from COVID-19 last week also represented a decline. The UN Health Agency said confirmed coronavirus infections were down in all regions of the world. However, it warned that the reported numbers carry considerable uncertainty because many countries have stopped widespread testing for the coronavirus. The organization says it is tracking an Omicron variant that is a recombination of two versions, BA1 and BA2, which was first detected in Britain in January. Oklahoma lawmakers overwhelmingly passed a bill to make performing an abortion in the state a felony, punishable by 10 years in prison and a $100,000 fine. The bill is likely to land on the desk of Republican Governor Kevin Stitt soon. Stitt has promised to sign all anti-abortion legislation. Oklahoma's bill is just one in a raft of Republican bills to severely restrict or ban abortion. The bills come before a widely anticipated Supreme Court case that disrupts nearly 50 years of established protections for abortion rights. If Oklahoma's bill passes into law, it will take effect this summer. I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines. And today, now, Take Our Poverty, Not Our Children, a truth commission organized by the National Welfare Rights Union. For full clarity, I am on the board of the National Welfare Rights Union. Today, you will hear from the chair of the National Welfare Rights Union, Detroit-based Marion Kramer, Washington, D.C.-based Melody Webb. She is an attorney with Mothers Outreach Network, ED. Delaware-based Dr. Mary Bricker Jenkins, who is on the board of the National Welfare Rights Union. Janie Johnson, a Brooklyn, New York-based social worker, and also several voices of mothers who have had their children wrongly taken from them.
My name is Sabina, and I'm your moderator for this evening. The purpose of the Truth Commission is to hear stories of those who are struggling for survival in this country that have been silenced. Many people around the world do not believe that poor people exist in the United States. A Truth Commission is a space where we can tell the truth about what's happening in this country and show that all these human rights violations have one thing in common, that they could have been prevented. It is a space for telling and listening to people's stories in a concrete, organized forum, and a space for analyzing the causes of and solutions for the preventable plights of their lives. It is also a space where we can indict our government for the human rights abuses it is committing against us. At this time, I have the esteemed honor of introducing you to the chair of the National Welfare Rights Union, Marion Kramer, who will go over the mission.
Well, too bad we can't be in the same room together, but it's so good to see some of you older folks, Mary BJ, and some of the young folks. And I'm happy that you are interested in joining this fight. And, you know, one thing that we are trying to do is to make sure that the poor and dispossessed have an opportunity to become leaders in this organization and begin to understand that if our children are going to survive, we're going to have to be out there also with them, half dead and everything else. We're going to have to be out there to fight, and I say it over and over again, to be able to help create a new society for all of us. We don't want no capitalists over our heads. We want to be able to enjoy life and our children be able to grow up and not worry about having food on the table. So that is what we all about, and we're looking for more and more of you to join the National Welfare Rights Union. Let's now educate. It's up to you.
Thank you so much, Marion. I will speak a little bit about how the event will work. We will begin to hear 3 to 5 minutes of testimony from our panels of speakers. Now I would like to turn it over to Dr. Mary Bricker Jenkins to go over the human rights framework.
Thank you, Savina. This is Mary Bricker Jenkins coming to you tonight from Delaware. Today is the International Human Rights Day, the day that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was proclaimed in 1948 to a world that had been ravaged by the Second World War and was desperately needing to affirm our rights and our dignity. It is, according to the United Nations website, a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations. It has many provisions, but tonight we are going to focus on one in particular, Article 25, which says, "Everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family." It was written in 1948, so they assume that his meant us too. We'll correct that. "Including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. In other words, every human being has the inherent right to the basic needs for survival. Article 25, Section 2 says motherhood and childhood are entitled to special care and assistance. And I'll just say, not because we're weak, but because we live in a system that denies us the full benefits of humanity. All children, whether born in and out of wedlock, shall enjoy the same social protection. This declaration was later translated into two covenants or treaties. One is the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which the United States signed and ratified, made it into a treaty, an enforceable treaty. The second covenant was on economic and social and cultural rights, which the United States signed but has never ratified, meaning that in the United States, it does not have the force of law. Why is that important? Because there are instruments that we could use and that would have to be enforced under our Constitution if we were to ratify the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. States, according to the United Nations, must, quote, respect, protect, and fulfill such rights. So another convention that derived from the Universal Declaration is the Convention on the Rights of the Child. The United States is the only member state in the United Nations that has never ratified that convention. That convention refers to the earlier convention, insisting that all economic, social, and cultural rights in the original declaration must be honored and protected. Not only have we failed to ratify the United States, but the powers that be have used all manner of rhetoric and circumlocution to avoid responsibility of our government to fulfill these rights to the basic human needs of survival, saying that they're only aspirational, that we could just aspire to them but not meet them, that they should be subsumed to under the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, which enshrine the role of private property and private corporations in government affairs. So why bother? Why should we bother with these if they're not worth the paper that they're written on? Because of their moral suasion, and because we do have, in fact, these rights that are universally recognized. In 1968, Martin Luther King said, it's time for us to move from civil rights to human rights. The so-called aspirational goals were so powerful that during the Civil Rights Movement, Eleanor Roosevelt, who chaired the committee that wrote the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, told civil rights leaders that it was necessary for them to cool it about economic rights. Our leader, Dottie Stevens, now deceased, of the Massachusetts chapter of the National Welfare Rights Union in the 1980s, saw the organizing potential of these rights. How much time do I have, timekeeper?
Miss Mary?
Yep.
Miss Mary, you have 12 seconds.
Okay. It was Dottie who told us to hold these truth commissions because they are a means of educating and organizing all of us to claim these rights. And we will say here now from our testifiers and from others, the means for doing so. Join us, everybody. Thank you.
At this time, I'm going to introduce to you Melanie Webb from Mother Outreach Network in D.C. Melanie Webb is a native Washingtonian and the executive director and founder of Mother's Outreach Network, a nonprofit organization that deploys movement lawyers' strategies to mobilize and empower primarily low-income Black mothers in Washington, D.C. to tackle systemic barriers to economic stability for their families. Melanie is a graduate of Harvard Law School and College and Washington, D.C.'s Benjamin Banneker Academic High School. She has spent her career practicing public interest law, and after law school, she clerked for the Honorable Emma G. Sullivan, then on the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. Since then, Melody has focused on legislative and policy advocacy at the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless, served as legislative counsel for U.S. Senator Robert Casey, and as associate general counsel for Service Employees International. Let me proudly introduce Melody Webb.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction, but I'll tell you what I am most proud of. I am most proud and honored to be here, and I'm proud that my work as a lawyer has brought me to this point. Why, as an attorney, am I doing this work? Well, I've done lots of public interest work, but this has been the deepest and most meaningful. My journey in this fight began when I became a parent defender 10 years ago in my own law practice. I would get cases the morning of a probable cause hearing when one of my clients had lost their child maybe a day or two before, and I would get the case notes, and I knew immediately that the deck was stacked against my client from the moment the child was ripped away from that parent. The assault on the parent continued, and I fought valiantly to defend them and to help them recover and reunify with their child, but often it was a lost cause because the parent had lost their child, they had lost their benefits, they had lost their housing. Parents lost an opportunity even to place their child with their preferred caregiver. But in fact, the injustice against the parents had begun long before the court case. We really should be fighting poverty. That is what lands the parents in this circumstance. But we're not fighting poverty. We're fighting families instead. We're surveilling primarily Black, Brown, and Indigenous families. We punish families and parents for their circumstances. And none of it needs to happen. This is poverty that is driving the child welfare system, the so-called child welfare system. Poverty is conflated with neglect. And here are my observations and ways that we can fight back. And again, I'm so honored to be amongst you and amongst the parents who have been impacted and who are working and fighting the system every day. Parents need a right to legal counsel before their children are removed. Our esteemed colleague, the warrior Joyce McMillan, wants us to provide Miranda-type warnings, the state to provide Miranda-type warnings to parents, to require the government to share with parents what their rights are when an agency has as soon as they begin the investigation. If the state knocks on your door, you need to have an attorney to advise you of the steps you can take, what your rights are. But too often, parents end up signing safety plans, which lead to them losing custody of their children. This whole kid and foster system, which we hear about and which has been written up in the news very recently. And you know what really has stood out to me in my studies and my representation of parents over these years? In Washington, D.C., 12% of families who are separated by the system, they're experiencing housing insecurity. The percentages are higher in other parts of the country. Well, we have tools to address all of these sources of poverty. For example, the Family Unification Program provides housing choice vouchers for these families who are at risk of involvement with the system or who are seeking to reunify. And how often are parents given those vouchers? These tools are underused. We also now have the child tax credit that is fully refundable in this current year, but yet in Washington, D.C., over half the families who were eligible did not access the child tax credit. We could have done more as a community and as the government. We need to get rid of the Adoption Safe Families Act, linking rights to your child to a ticking clock with an arbitrary cutoff point. That's inhumane. We should eliminate the failure to protect as a basis for child removal. A mother fighting for her life from an abuser then has to turn around and fight to keep her children. These and many other things we need to fight in support of our mothers, our fellow mamas fighting to keep their children. I am committed and I look forward to working with all of you in supporting mothers and caregivers in fighting this inhumane system.
Now we're going to move into the first set of testimonies. My name is Lenora Brown Elk, and recently in June of 2021, I made the error of leaving my son in the car when I ran into the store. He wasn't harmed, but someone called the police. They took my son away from me. They threw me in jail. They took my son away for 2 months. I found out through that process and by this initiative that they have a legal right to be able to take children who are under the age of 2 and adopt them out without the parents' consent. When I found that out, I didn't have him back yet, and I was terrified. I was horrified. I didn't know what to do. So it made me fight harder, but I definitely want to speak for mothers like myself and for the mothers who have lost their children to this terrible law that allows that. Mothers should be given more love and empathy and respect and should definitely have say-so. DCFS, give us our children back.
In December 2012, I asked my oldest daughter's paternal grandparents if they would babysit, and they agreed, and they were supposed to only keep her overnight. And instead of bringing her back to me, I was given a white envelope that had a pendant-like custody order in it. And then a few days later, when I showed up in court, I found out that they had filed for emergency custody, stating that I left my daughter on their doorstep and they didn't know how to get in touch with me or where to find me. After that, the judge gave them full custody with no way of getting my daughter back because he felt more comfortable with her being in a two-parent home than with a single parent who didn't have a real job. And at that time, I was a waitress. It took me 9 years to get her back.
I do believe that not all cases should be the way they are treated, especially when certain parents go through the first domestic violence. In my case, things are being used against us that are not true, and there's no way we could prove our point because DCFS doesn't listen to you. They don't help you. They really don't help you at all. It's really you're on your own in this world with DCFS. It's very stressful, very frustrating, and at the end of the day, they don't know what they're doing to those families. I speak for myself personally. I believe my son is going through something that he shouldn't be going through just because he's always been with me. I've always been with him. His dad's always been there for him, you know, but he's not the perfect dad. We're not the perfect parents, but we always have taken care of our kid. I strongly believe that DCFS should consider the fact that when it's your first domestic violence ever after so many years dating with this partner, like in my case, been 17 years, they shouldn't be removing the kids because not only they separate families, it's like we go through a trauma because we don't know when we're going to see each other again. We don't know when we're going to speak to each other again. Our kids are left behind like wondering what happened or wondering if they did something wrong when it's not the case. It's just how DCFS takes it and how our voices are not being heard.
In 2016, I gave birth to a beautiful little girl. The hospital drug tested my child and I without my consent and called Children's Services. I still remember laying in the hospital bed holding her when they walked in to take her from me and put her in the nursery to tell me that I could no longer be alone with her anymore and that they were taking her into their custody. I still remember the pain I felt leaving that hospital alone, not knowing where to go or who to turn to for help. Family separation has been something that America not only has pocketed throughout the years, but something that plays a major part in parents and family members experiencing loss, even though the child is still alive. My daughter is now 5 years old. I have not seen her since she was 3 months old. During my time of incarceration, she was adopted out without my consent and without my knowledge. I was only incarcerated for 6 months, and it took them 3 months to set the plan for adoption and finalize it. We all know that it takes longer for a parent to be sentenced to jail or prison time than that. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about my daughter. But what really hurts the most is not even having the chance to see her or even know that she's okay. I sit and I dream about what she might look like. Does she look like me? Does she look like my other daughter? If only I could just have a picture just to see how she's doing would make all the difference. I think it's important for the social workers to know the trauma of the separation impacts the children, the parents, and the entire family units. No one in my family has ever had the chance to see my daughter. Not my mother, not her brothers or her sister. And it's hard to explain to my kids where their sister is. You know, they remember me being pregnant with her, but they've never had the chance to see her. The child welfare system took advantage of my situation of homelessness and substance abuse issues and used that to keep me from my child. Numerous times I went into child services agency only to be turned away and told to leave my name and number and someone will get back to me. No one ever did. I have filed many petitions with the courts only to continuously be denied. But as painful as it is, I know that God works all things out for the good. I have been able to turn my whole life around and have stepped into my purpose because of this situation. I now am aspiring to become a dependency lawyer so that I can help parents who have unjustly had their children taken away by child welfare system. It's almost impossible to navigate the child welfare system alone. During that time, I didn't have not one single person to tell me what my rights were or to help me fight back. That's why it's so important that the community comes together to help families fight this racist system that was just designed to disproportionately tear apart Black and Brown families.
My name is Janina Gorman. I currently live in a small rural city in Blair County, Pennsylvania, and I'm a member of Put People First Pennsylvania and the PA Poor People's Campaign. And I work with Every Mother is a Working Mother Network and Global Men's Strike. You may not know it by looking at me, but I am a quarter Iroquois and half Irish. And in 2013, I was a single mother with five small children, 12 and under. Two of my daughters were on the autism spectrum and needed additional care. As a woman who fled domestic violence, my ex withheld support as a means of punishment, which forced us into low-income housing. So I had to pay weekly out of pocket. Due to my housing situation in August of 2013, my children were suddenly removed from my care. CYOS informed me that if I signed over temporary guardianship to a relative and completed the treatment plan, my children should be returned to me within 3 weeks before school started. It has now been 8 years, in which time I have successfully completed 6 treatment plans, and still my fight continues. It has been a huge fight, but since 2019, 3 of my children have now been returned home. The battle continues for us. All 3 are now actively being treated for physical abuse, sexual abuse, and PTSD. When none of them had any markers for any physical or sexual abuse when they were in my care. We have been given little to no financial support when foster families here are given nearly $3,000 per month per child. I work very hard to advocate for my children's mental health needs and IEP services every day, but in so many ways, I feel that the services offered are setting us up to fail rather than providing the help and support we need. One big lifeline for me has been the child tax credit. This country has a long and ugly history of forcibly separating Native families. In fact, I am the first generation who were not physically removed and taken to a residential school like the one my grandmother was forced into in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It is understood that these institutions and laws were a foundation for what is now known today as the child welfare system. Continuing the legacy of forced removals and family separation, the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978, which is under attack currently. We are seeing the continuation of this brutal legacy today. Why we're here today and why I've had the victories is because we all came together and we fought so hard for them. When we come together and fight, we win, and we can win. Thank you.
Crystal Sanchez from the Sacramento Union of the Homeless, California.
Hi there. I'm here today to say, take our poverty, not our children. My name is Crystal Sanchez, and I am the president of the Sacramento Homeless Union and the Western Regional Director for the National Union of the Homeless. And I come to you today as an adult who was a child of this broken system, but that's not why I'm here to talk. I'm here today to talk about what's happening in the 5th largest economy of the world, which is California. I'm going to explain to you guys what we are seeing in the encampments, because I think that is important. We currently have a membership of over 25 unhoused individuals here in Sacramento and a network of mutual aid of over 500 community members. So what we're seeing, I have personally been involved in delivering babies in the back of vehicles to keep them undocumented. We have to do this because CPS comes and takes unhoused children. What we are seeing is that right now, currently, we have 11,000 people in Sacramento who are unhoused. 700 of those are children. We lack 63,000 units of affordable housing. We don't have shelter. We don't have the resources that folks need. So what is happening is we are seeing law enforcement coming into our encampments, and they are sweeping our unhoused individuals. With this being said, law enforcement is befriending families with children. They come in with social workers, and then they come remove these children. Now, there's a law in California that states that they may not take children for the fact that they are living in a tent. However, they are taking these children based on other things, including what they are calling child endangerment, which is children being in these encampments around people who may be registered, needles, things that necessarily you cannot prevent. So what's it like to grow up in an encampment? The children that we have out in the encampments, it's really, really hard. Parents have to keep them in their RVs or in their tents. And what we again are seeing is these massive sweeps where they are taking all of their shelters. A lot of our kids do not go to school due to the fact that parents are afraid that CPS is going to intervene and take those children from the schools. Something else that we are seeing in these encampments, I work with a lot of families who are trying to get their children back. They have to jump through these massive hoops that are nearly impossible for somebody who is unhoused to jump through. When they do receive judgments for children to be returned, we are having CPS actually calling us an on-the-ground advocacy group asking us for housing. We do not have housing. And again, these are systemic issues that we are seeing children being removed based on the inequities that our city and county have put in place. We're seeing kids being taken from these encampments and placed in foster care. I'm an ex-foster care group home youth. This system, we all know, is really, really rough. They are fast-tracking adoptions. Again, people cannot jump through these hoops quick enough, and then they are adopting these children out. We are also seeing, this is very dangerous, we have women, again, giving birth on the streets because they fear those children are going to be taken away. So again, we are the fifth largest economy in the world. There's absolutely no reason that we should be going through this.
We're going to hear from Madison Williams, Alexandria House, California.
I've experienced DCFS on both sides. As a youth, I had many social workers in and out of the household after my father passed at 9 years old. I was abused, and many reports were made over the years. And it wasn't until I was 12 years old that I was placed with my uncle and aunt. And back in those days, DCFS did not intervene anymore if you were placed with a family member. At 16, I ended up living with my mother, and it was not a good situation. She was on drugs. I ended up in a shelter/group home. The social worker did not want to open a case, stating that I was almost of age. I was 17. And I was going to age out soon. So she kind of just left me. The shelter ended up keeping me longer than the DCFS would let them. It's against the rules to keep anybody who is not part of DCFS longer than 30 days. And they kept me for a little bit longer. When I was 18, I didn't have any services. I didn't have family. I didn't have anything. I was homeless. Most people still receive extra care after 18 to help them. And I was not eligible since that social worker would not open that DCFS case. So that was my experience with DCFS on that side. Later in life, I became a foster mom. And so I had contact again with DCFS. Crazy, but I had a great social worker in the beginning. She understood my uncomfortability on monitoring visits. She did not push adoption. She didn't do any of those things. But then she went on maternity leave. So then I got a really bad social worker. My foster daughter was in dance, cheerleading, and at a private school. This other social worker did not care. She took her out of school. She missed so much school. The school almost kicked her out. She was pushing adoption and also making me do visits with the parents who were rightfully agitated with me and still using. There are many false accusations. I ended up having to give my foster daughter up. But because of the false accusations, ever since then, somehow I've been having more and more false accusations. In the last 2 years, I've had been investigated 6 times. Now, trying to help somebody, I'm now am a target. Now, while I've had a good experience with that one first social worker, when I was a foster parent, I've learned that that definitely isn't the experience that other people are having on the other side. I also learned that the community support that I was given, partnering with Alexandria House and being part of that community, is what helped me keep my kids with all of these false accusations.
We're going to take a short station break. When we return, we will continue to hear the voices from Take Our Poverty, Not Our Children.
Thank you.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check out our website at sotrueradio.org. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And our handle on Instagram and Twitter at sotrueradio. We're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. Today, I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Detroit, Michigan. And internationally, I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the Netherlands. And we now return to Take Our Poverty, Not Our Children, voices from a truth commission organized by the National Welfare Rights Union.
Now we're going to view Vanessa Noisy's words, and she is from the Apache Stronghold.
Dagoteshi Vanessa Noisy Gosashi, San Carlos Goliu, Shi Chokau Ine, Ahia. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. My name is Vanessa Noisy. I'm an enrolled member of the San Carlos Apache tribe, and I'm Chuakau Apache. Today, I talk to you about the worries of a mother, an Apache mother. I have four beautiful, amazing daughters that's at risk. And why I say they're at risk is because a foreign mining company called Resolution Copper is wanting to destroy our holy and sacred site, Chichilpatagutil Oak Flat. With that being said, that means that my religion and my way of life is at risk. The teachings that were given to me by my ancestors that have been passed down from generations to generation will no longer exist if Chichilpatagutil Oak Flat is destroyed. That means that my kids and those yet to be born will not have a future. Not only is our future of Mother Earth, Nagosan, is being destroyed and well, I apologize because I get emotional, but what I'm trying to say is that Mother Earth is at stake, and if we continue to rip the natural resources that were provided to give us shelter, to give us water, to give us food, is at risk of being destroyed all over this country, then our future generations do not have a sustainable world to live in. Along with the environment being at stake and being at risk for complete destruction, as indigenous people, as an Apache, that means our religion and our way of life and our identity is at risk. It's a constant, continued fight that we have been battling with the U.S. government for centuries, and it's still living today. My kids will either take up the fight and be Apache and be able to have the freedom to pray at our holy places, to feel the spirit that's alive, that we believe in, or will they only fantasize of what it is to be Apache? That's what's at stake for my people, a complete genocide of who we are that was given to us by Creator. But remember, if my way of life is at stake, my religion is at stake, so is everyone else's. They have been doing this to us for over 500 years. But we are making a stand. I am making a stand. And I ask those that are in power, those that have the ability to make change in this world, to do so. Because I'm fighting not only for my children, but I'm fighting for yours and those yet to be born. No one will be able to live in this world without clean air, clean water. And if my religion is at stake, so is yours. We as indigenous people look 7 generations ahead. And right now, we are not going down the right road. There will be no world for our children to live in. So I'm not just looking and talking on the indigenous point of view, but I'm looking as a mother. Mother Earth is hurting. Mother Earth is sick. And if we continue to rip her apart, our future children will have no existence. And if my religion is always being attacked and has complete genocide, then what does that leave for my people? When we talk about fighting for our sacred sites throughout Indian country, we're fighting for those yet to be born. We need the system to change. We need actual people to make moral decision and support the people, because we all are fighting against a system that wasn't meant for us. So please, let's make change. Let's give our future children opportunities to survive. Don't kill the spirit that was given by Creator. Everything is alive. We breathe and we see beautiful creations, but we are taking it for granted. And we are witnessing a murder on Mother Earth. So let's not add to the problem. We need you to fix it so that our future generations can survive. Ahia.
Hi, my name is Maricela Ramos. I entered the foster care system when I was a preteen. I was physically abused by my father. Being taken away from my parents was one of the traumatizing moments in my life. I was placed into a group home where I suffered depression from the mental abuse I was experiencing. I never felt safe, and I never felt that my voice mattered. I was later adopted by a wonderful lady who taught me about love and compassion. I was emancipated at the age of 18 without knowing all the benefits of staying in the system. I fell in love and I had kids at a young age. Going to college seemed impossible for me. I added and dropped classes all the time because I felt keeping a roof over my head for my kids was more important. My foster parent passed away when I was 23. I didn't have any additional support. I became homeless. I was couch surfing, sleeping in the car, getting hotel vouchers from the county. And those hotel vouchers are limited. They only give it to you for like 14 days. I found out about 211 only to be thrown into a circle that led me into a dead end. I had to do my own research and go to these shelters directly. Alexandra was able to open their doors for me and my kids. I was able to have a structure so I can go back to school and get a part-time job. I got the support that I needed. I got therapy for me and my kids. And I also found out about the Guardian Scholars Program through another nonprofit organization. I feel that we need more organizations like Alexander House that have an open community where you feel safe. The community helped me realize that there is good people out there. Even if you feel the system has failed you, there is a light of hope that I am worthy of having a place on this earth. So I guess I didn't know how much time I was going to have to speaking, but I wanted to say that being in the foster care system was never easy, and I think that when you're in a system, you always want to run away, and you think you can just figure it out on your own, but then you realize that you just hit a dead end. So it takes a lot to put your pride aside and ask for help. And I think the barriers that I had is that those resources weren't available to me. They weren't given to me. So the deck of cards was always put against, at least for me, I felt like they were always against me. And I don't want the next generation to struggle and suffer. So that is why I feel like it's important to talk about these issues that are going on in the foster care system.
Janie Johnston, LCSW, Brooklyn, New York.
I've become the matriarch. And so in that, I've taken on the responsibility of making sure that all of my children, anyway, are okay and understand what they need to do, including other people, with my family and other people. So I'm here to tell my story about my granddaughter, who had tried to get benefits in South Carolina, where she was living, soon after she had a baby. She was pregnant and she was able to get Medicaid, and she had some issues with the delivery. She had to go back into the hospital because she developed an infection. And when she came out, I think it was about 2 days after she came out of the hospital, she applied for WIC because she needed the milk for the baby. And so she applied on the phone. They told her that they would send her the papers to fill out. She had to sign them and send them back. They sent her the papers. There was a deadline. By the time she received the papers, the deadline was over. She called back a second time. The second set came after the deadline again. So we're not sure if it was the mail or if it just was, you know, the way they work down in South Carolina. So she said she was going to try one more time. And she called up and she requested the papers. And again, they came after the deadline. She didn't have the money to buy milk and diapers and everything for the baby. This also affected her mental health because she, you know, after she had the baby, her first priority was her son. And when you can't provide for your children, it really, you know, interferes with everything in your life. It makes it very hard to go from day to day. We all talked about it. We were on the phone all day long, and we got through it. And that's what I think is needed, just being able to surround yourself with people who are facing sometimes similar situations, or just talking to each other. You know, you have to let it out. And that's what I tell everyone. When you keep it in, it festers and it grows, and it's not a good thing. My granddaughter started this process when the baby was 2 weeks old. The baby is now 9 months old, and that's when she decided she was going to come to New York. She came to my house, and she stayed with me for a couple of days. We told her what she needed to do. She applied online for her benefits, which was public assistance with cash, WIC, and SNAP. This was on Monday. On Tuesday, she received her benefits. She received, I think it was $120 for her and the baby in cash, $400 in food stamps and WIC. She had no help in South Carolina. So, you know, with my help and my daughter's help, she was able to navigate the system and it worked out well for her. I mean, within a couple of days, she was able to start taking care of herself, which is what she wanted to do. And this is what everyone needs, but it's really hard for them to do that because they don't have the money or the knowledge and knowledge in terms of what resources are available to them. The system has changed over the years. It's not like it used to be. Not like when their mothers or grandmothers were on public assistance. It's very different today. So you have to know how to navigate it, or you're homeless or you have no food. Even as a social worker, I've had so many clients who lived on the subway for days before someone was able to help them. I had a whole family that was living in the subway. The mother had passed away. The father had five children, and they were riding the subway until someone asked why weren't the kids going to school. And the kids were actually put in foster care because he couldn't care for them. And I mean, it was sad. Instead of giving him help, took his kids away. But you know, this is what the system does to some families. And you have people who are just trying to get food, you know, trying to stay dry, you know, trying to keep that roof over their head. Those are the basics. That's what they need. We're not even talking about the extras, but just the basics. We have to find a way. We have to find a way, just like we do with everything else. You know, we find a way to get the money, and we take care of the people within our country, you know, and then it just spreads, you know. But we have to find a way to get the money, whichever way we, you know, whatever we have to do. If we have to pay more taxes, then we have to pay more taxes. I mean, but I think there's, if we all work together, we'll get the money somehow. There's no one else to do it. We have to do it.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank the National Welfare Rights Union and the People's Forum for allowing us to share this material with you. I'd like to thank the board op for today, and also I'd like to thank our assistant producer, Alicia Vargas, who did the editing of this material from Take Our Children, Not Our Poverty. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and you all remember to stay well and safe. Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.5.